Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the gold medalist of the education policy world, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, how you doing, babe?
I'm good. How about you?
Good. You've been watching those Winter Olympics?
I have to admit, I have been.
I know you like those Olympics.
I am. Though, you know, folks will notice that we are not doing an Education Olympics this time around.
Why not?
We did for the summer. Well, because we did this a year and a half ago for the Summer Olympics, looking at, you know, how the U.S. has done in international competition educationally. And frankly, nothing has changed in the last year and a half. You know, there's, yeah, I mean, we have to stage the competition. You know, we use PISA scores, TIMSS scores. Well, nothing's really new. And yet, Bob Wise at the Alliance for Excellent Education, he's supposedly, quote, in Vancouver doing his Education Olympic shtick.
Really?
Yeah. There was a picture from the other day in his ski gear with the snow blowing behind him. Only problem being that it wasn't actually snowing in Vancouver.
Ooh, but that's almost more authentic than really being in Vancouver.
Yeah. All right, so here's the question I have for you, Rick. We were not on the air last week because of Snowmageddon here in the Washington area, the incredible two blizzards in a row. This is my question, Rick. Were you doing the shoveling at your house, or was Jolene? Tell the truth.
I contributed to the shoveling at my house.
Oh, I'm impressed.
Indeed. Well, you know what would happen was I was sitting here I was crashing on the last stages of a manuscript. So I'd be sitting there writing away like Dickens. And then you'd hear little tiny footsteps outside with a little shovel going, arr, arr.
Was she using one of those kids' shovels? I got one for Nico. No,
she looked like a small person wielding one of these giant, like oversized kind of devices. So then I would go down and help out.
Oh, that's very good.
We're a team, man.
Well,
we're a team.
Good.
How about at the Petrilli household?
Oh yeah. Well, my wife just gave birth, you know, 6 weeks ago. I was definitely doing the shoveling. Yes.
You're a good man.
But it felt good. It was good exercise. I liked it. Okay, you know what? We can't babble on forever, though we did have a little extra time in the script because, listeners, let's just be honest with you right from the start. Amber Winkler on vacation.
Whoa.
All right. So we understand if you're going to just turn it off right now.
No research minute?
Wait, no research minute. Amber is on her way to Bangkok because I know people are going to be very upset about their lack of a research minute.
Mm.
But Rick and I, we'll figure out a plan for how to use that minute later in the show.
I think we already used it.
Productively. Yeah, we probably did. All right. So
I see our producer Laura nodding.
This is the point of the show where I always say, but there's a lot to cover this week. But let me be honest with you. There's not a lot to cover. I mean, you know, the blizzard hits Washington and New York, and all of a sudden there's like nothing happening in the education policy world, which I know makes me sound like I think that everything happens in Washington. It doesn't. But scour the nation's newspapers. There was like no education news last week to speak of.
And I got to say, we could probably poll the parents of 50-odd million kids out there.
Yeah.
And I think the notion that the education policy world was at a standstill for an entire week would register not one whit.
Do you know that the U.S. Department of Education was closed down for 4 days in a row? You probably did not know that. Did anybody?
Which makes you wonder if non-essential personnel may be truly, you know, non-essential.
Okay, we have now used up Amber's research minute, so it's time for us to play Pardon the Gadfly. Janie, let's get going.
All right, question one. Mike, you've had a lively email and blog exchange with Gary Orfield over the past few weeks regarding the Civil Rights Project's recent report on racial segregation in charter schools. Is the existence of charter schools that are 100% poor or minority a problem? And if so, what is the solution?
Yeah, you know, so Rick, this has been interesting. You know, a couple weeks ago, the UCLA Civil Rights Project comes out with this big study showing that there's more racial isolation going on in charter schools than traditional schools. Basically, there are a lot of charter schools out there that serve nothing but poor African-American and Hispanic kids. And Gary Orfield and his colleagues think this is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Huge debate has ensued, you know, and you can understand from the perspective of, say, KIPP or Achievement First, these high-performing networks, they say, look, well, are you kidding me? You're going to give us a hard time because we have figured out a way to serve a high concentration of poor kids effectively, and now you're saying that somehow we're racist? On the other hand, you know, you also can see the point that says, look, there's a lot of reasons why we'd prefer to have integrated schools in this country for social reasons, and even educationally, there's plenty of studies that show that on average, poor kids, minority kids do better in integrated schools. So there's some truth to both of these sides.
Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, there's another point, which was pretty much absent last week, but it's the one Steve Macedo, the Princeton political theorist, made probably about a decade ago, which was like, look, maybe one of the things that tends to characterize high-performing parochial schools is the very fact that they have a concentrated population, that they're serving a particular kind of student who is bound by parental comfort with certain norms, with certain expectations. And maybe if you're trying to build an intense, sweat-the-small-stuff environment, it's actually easier to do when kids are pretty similar and come with pretty similar expectations.
Yeah, and you know, one more point to make. You know, there was a lot of talk about how Gary Orfield was being elitist. You know, these elites that don't, you know, that want to be controlling about where poor and minority parents send their kids to school. You know, second guessing a parent that says, "Hey, I want an all-black school for my kid if it's doing great." And yet, you know, look, in the charter school movement, we're just as elitist because we say to those same parents, "Hey, if you chose an all-black charter school and its test scores suck, we're going to close that school down, mm-hmm. even if you like it." You know, so I just think that there was some hypocrisy in there as well.
Good for you, babe.
Yeah, baby. All right. Topic number two, Jenny.
Okay. Parents in Beaufort County, South Carolina.
Beaufort, sorry.
have introduced a lawsuit arguing that their children were
lawsuit.
Not a lawsuit arguing that their children were
children.
arguing that their children were not provided an equal educational opportunity after they were given extensive suspension due to a school fight. Do you think that they have a case?
Janie, way to muscle through. Two thoughts on this. First, thus it progresses that we are managing to turn everything in this country into entitlement, which invites these kinds of claims. Second thing is, you know, adolescent boys fight. This notion that you're going to administer 2 month suspensions because boys are get into a fist fight or whatnot on the school bus or on school grounds, you know, I think this is part of what Richard Whitmire is talking about when he talks about our understanding of school and our expectations being framed in ways that aren't necessarily realistic about how young males are going to interact.
Interesting set. So you have this soft bigotry of low expectations for
male behavior. I always worry about guys who've never been in a single fight come age 15.
What's wrong with that?
they're very polite, though.
But some of us have sparred verbally with people. Thank you very much. Here are these guys.
Rules around guns and knives. I understand this. But I'm suggesting that I understand punishments. I understand a couple days. I was suggesting that a 2 month suspension for a fist fight is wildly disproportionate.
No, I don't disagree. So if you're the parent of that kid, why don't you go to the courts and sue and say, this school district is being ridiculous. My kid should be in school getting an education. Instead, they're going to flunk out because of this ridiculous ruling. Topic number three.
The so-called parent trigger has been activated at Mount Gleason Middle School in Los Angeles, forcing district officials to pick one of a few turnaround strategies to fix the school. And momentum is building for parent trigger legislation in Connecticut. Is this the new face of local accountability?
Rick, are people trigger happy? Boom.
Wow.
But Rick, explain. I'm still a little confused about the parent trigger. How does this stuff work?
I don't know.
Oh, Rick. I thought you're like close friends with Steve Barr and you hang out and have drinks with him and you understand what this thing is.
I don't. Right? I mean, parents have the right under certain to ask that schools be reconstituted
in a variety of ways. It's like the new California law, right? It passed as part of the Race to the Top reforms that a majority of the parents can vote to trigger the school has to reconstitute.
Within some window of time.
I don't know. It has to go to the school board. Basically, it's a way for parents to voice that they are not happy and they want to see.
But what I don't fully understand is, I mean, that you also have in these schools collective bargaining agreements that are in place. You have other state statutes on the books. So what happens when with the parents? I don't really understand how these things are going to
play out. All right, but let me ask you this. I mean, it seems like there's a renewed interest in the education reform community for this grassroots organizing stuff. You know, everybody's excited about what Steve Barr has been able to do in Los Angeles. Maybe it's having a community organizer as president. I don't know. People are excited about this idea. Power to the people. But, I mean, I feel like we were through this before, right? I mean, in New York City in the late 60s, early 70s, community control. I mean, haven't we been down
this
road?
This was Chicago school reform in 88, right? I mean, what happens is that you have a certain, you know, there's some number of parents who are enthused and energized and going to take advantage of it. But the problem is, it's yet an 08 problem. It's much harder to kind of fan the flames of enthusiasm across parents broadly and to keep those lit.
Yeah. Well, and And what seems to have happened both in New York City and later in Chicago is a lot of this breaks down into local racial politics,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, in New York City in the 60s and 70s, it was all about, you know, trying to get black control of black schools. And there's huge conflict between black communities and Jewish teachers that got very ugly. And then in Chicago, you had the situation where there were principals that were either doing a great job and got fired because they were not the same race as the local community, or vice versa, people getting hired for patronage reasons. I mean, it's so, this stuff is tricky.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the fact is that racial tensions and class tensions and neighborhood tensions are certainly more enduring than the ability to organize parents around an education reform agenda.
Yeah.
And that's what we saw in Chicago. You know, Tony Brake's work on site-based management was pretty revealing on this stuff.
You know, and that in some of these urban communities where education jobs, both teaching but everything else too, the janitors, et cetera, are some of the best jobs around.
Sure.
You've just got a dynamic here where it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. And if this is this underbelly we don't like to talk about you know, empowering communities, that sometimes when you do that, you know, it comes down to basics. People want jobs. People want favors. And
yeah, that's you know, this is interesting. We've got one or two tiny examples. You know, we got 14,000 districts, and so you know, if we start to see some of this, it'll be as interesting as hell to see how it unfolds.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. It is now the time when we would usually have Amber's Research Minute. But she's in Bangkok. Should we have a moment of silence?
We could have a moment, or we could hum a little song to her.
Oh, I like that. Yeah. What kind of song?
What's something that Amber would like?
We could just say for a minute, we could say something. Research Minute, Research Minute. Actually, Rick.
You can air guitar to that.
You're like a research guru. Could you just tell us about some study you've read recently? What's on your bedside table right now, Rick?
A whole bunch of stuff from the 1940s, man. I don't think it's all that cutting edge.
All right. Well, then let me use a little bit of this time to say, Rick Hess in the house on the blog. You have launched your new blog, Straight Talk with Rick Hess.
Well, thank you, babe.
On the Edweek site, everybody should go check it out. There's a silhouette there of somebody who looks like, I don't know, some good-looking skinny guy.
Looks like me, baby.
In a sharp suit. Who is that guy?
That's me, Doc. A little bit of hair trimming. I was fresh from the gym.
All right, so Rick, your first blog post was 982 words long. Question is, are you blogging or are you just peeling off chapters of your book?
Mike, hold on. So you know to the precise total the word count of the blog. Can you tell me a single idea that was
no,
in the blog?
Because I'm not going to read a blog post that's 982 words long. And as somebody told me
what's the largest number of words that you read? You agree to read, Mike?
300, maybe 400.
Okay.
And somebody told us, an expert that Laura had bring in, you know, if it's not read, it doesn't exist.
Rick, you do not exist.
You do not exist.
Or at least Mike doesn't have the time to read it. So in Mike's world, that don't exist. That hurts.
I did think it was interesting, though, Rick. You took a cynical take on merit pay, which I haven't heard in our podcast venue. But I think this is a new side of you that we're coming to see. And I'm...
Well, you can do more. You can do more nuance. Now, of course, in 300 words, it's hard to do much nuance. So, I am afraid I'm going to have to inflict longer.
You just
phrases.
Have to take one topic at a time. All right, little short thoughts.
I can't do one topic in 300 words and do it any justice and say anything original or interesting.
You know, it's much harder to write briefly than it is to write at length.
It's much harder to say anything interesting or that's not regurgitated than it is to repackage
right to
orthodoxy.
All right. But you know who's going to get
your
straight to the
point? Your exchange with Gary Orfield. How long was that? 300 words?
No, that was longer. You're right.
So you actually said something interesting. See, it takes a little longer.
Yeah. It was particularly interesting because his responses were in all caps. Okay, but you know who is good at getting right to the point? It is Mickey's Rate That Reform.
Nice.
Okay. Yes.
There's music playing. You know,
oh,
just
I'm not,
talk
hearing,
right through
I'm
the
not
music.
Hearing any music. I'm sorry.
I'm not hearing any music.
Yeah.
Oh. No,
I am without music. My earphones are musicless, man.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, there was music.
If Amber were here, she'd be
so. Folks might be wondering. First of all, why is Mickey wearing a sling?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Wait, it's a podcast. You can't see that he's in a sling, but he is. So, Mickey, why are you wearing a sling?
I had arthroscopic surgery on my right shoulder February 1st. This was from a 2-plus-year-old water skiing injury that I had when I attempted to go over a jump. Without any experience in water skiing acrobatics, and slipped off the side and had...
Okay, tell to the judge.
Yeah, this is a story Mickey tells because he doesn't want to say that Checker, you know, grabbed his arm and bent it behind his back a few weeks ago. But anyways, that's an ugly story.
So rate that reform. Yeah.
So the second point is, why is Mickey here instead of Stafford?
Why is Mickey
here? Answer, Stafford's out sick.
Okay.
This happens. So Mickey, rate that reform. What are we talking about today?
Okay, we're talking about grading. So whenever I read a headline that says, quote, students in charge of own education, I feel a certain Hessian cynicism. I once taught at a school in Brazil where five-year-olds were in charge of their own education, and needless to say, it was not a good place. But an article last week from the Oregon Statesman Journal with that very headline had me intrigued. It turns out that Oregon's Race to the Top application features a curricular model that does allow students to take a lot of control over their education, and it just might work. The idea is a proficiency model whereby grades are determined by student mastery of state standards rather than by accumulation of points from homework and assessments. The student expectations for learning are clear and universal, but they have much more control and flexibility about how to achieve them. In Falls City, Oregon, where the system is already in place, students may retake tests, relearn material, and in general tweak their own learning sequence, ensuring that they remain focused on covering the standards and not just on following a single idiosyncratic curriculum written by a single idiosyncratic teacher. You may remember that I gave Spokane Washington Schools a rare A for implementing something like this last year, and I'm giving Falls City, Oregon the same this time around. There are, of course, plenty of ways that this proficiency-based grading can go wrong, but the blunt instrument of letter-based grading as it currently exists is far worse.
So what grade are we going to give to Mickey for regurgitating his Rate That Reforms? I mean, Mickey, no offense here, but yeah. You know, you don't take the Rate That Reform chair all that often.
That's true.
I mean, the same topic, I was like, I kept saying to myself, I feel like I've heard this before.
That's true.
And sure enough,
but
the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest, the proficiency stuff.
Yes, but see, the thing is, I don't blog. There are very few things about which I'm actually genuinely opinionated so far in my brief experience in education policy world. And this is one of those few developments that I saw and that I liked, and that I'm gonna, if I need to, get out on my own personal soapbox to defend. I think that the grading standards is something that is just out of date, that doesn't work, that's just far too blunt, and if I do any good or make any contribution to the debate thus far, I want to be a plug of proficiency-based grading.
Wow. Mickey Muldoon, killing grading as we know it.
Well, you know what I noticed? That this is Falls City. It sounds pretty cool. But Jimmy Stewart?
Yeah.
Bedford Falls, baby. It was Bedford Falls.
Yeah. That's all
movies?
You got? That's all you got? That's all?
Is that kind of...
Zuzu's pedals? People, work with me here.
I have no idea what Rick's talking about now. All right. Could you cut Rick's microphone off?
Philistines, baby.
All right. Now, thanks, Mickey. But there was some other bizarre stuff in the news this week, too.
It's a wonderful life.
Yeah.
Yeah, a wonderful.
But I like the idea of rating actual reforms rather than doing the pink slip type thing.
No, all right. Mickey trying to bring substance to the show. Well, you got to respect him for that, I guess. One last point, though. Rick, did you see this, that in the Detroit area, a Detroit area PR firm got school districts to pay them $25,000 apiece to be listed as among the best school districts in the Detroit area?
You know,
this
sometimes
is a nice
we call
pay to play.
Yeah, sometimes we call that extortion.
Yeah, a little payola there.
And it's actually it's kind of what the consultant firms are doing with states with Race to the Top. We're going to hold out the good stuff unless you get that quarter mil, baby.
Yeah, I like that. So we wanted to announce that actually recently the Thomas B. Fordham Institute was found to be the best think tank in the world. And you can check it out. There's a PR company that's been working on this.
How much did you pay him?
That's undisclosed. Yeah, undisclosed. All right. That's all the time we got till next week. Until then,
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show at edexcellence.net, signing off.